At about 20:00, the G2 reported that all the Iraqi heavy units had remained in place. That evening, I continued to monitor reports of Corps activity coming into the command post over the radio. 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment kept up attacks and combat activities all night. In other words, they did not stop at sundown, get out their sleeping bags, and get 8 or 10 hours of sleep. They continued movement to adjust unit formations, get better force protection, and also put out reconnaissance. The rest of the Corps was not idle that night. In 1st Armored Division, the lead unit had pushed 60 kilometers into Iraq, well forward of the rest of the division. Elsewhere in the division, 3 soldiers were wounded when a vehicle struck a mine just over the border. Meanwhile, refueling operations and movement forward of the division into their division wedge would continue until after 0200 on the 25th. The division had taken prisoners, but by now the count was not accurate. 3rd Armored Division continued moving units forward over the border and continued refueling operations well into the night. Their lead unit had reported engaging 29 tanks with close air support and later capturing more prisoners. Other prisoners bypassed by 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment also were captured by division units. As 1st Infantry continued to mark lanes, their aviation forward also conducted a screen of their ground elements so as to preempt any Iraqi artillery from firing on forces refueling for tomorrow's operation. The British reported closing into an area just south of the breach, ready to begin passage of lines. Finally, I learned we had used 44 close air support strikes. In sum, I was pleased with the Corps that day. Our agility in adjusting to the 15-hour advance and attack had been superb. 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment and lead elements of 1st Armored Division were now 60 kilometers deep into Iraq and continuing actions. 1st Infantry had completed 24 lanes. Through these, the 2,500 tracked vehicles and 5,000 wheeled vehicles of the British would move, followed by the 400 logistics vehicles and the fuel that would allow the enveloping divisions to attack the Republican Guards without stopping, and the over 1,000 vehicles of the 2 Corps artillery brigades that would join the enveloping divisions. We were in the posture I wanted. The bottom line that night was that I thought the Republican Guards would stay in a posture that would make Frag Plan 7 the best scheme of attack. I needed one more look to confirm it the next day. My key reads the next day would be our posture and the Iraqis. Then I would decide. Commanders of large campaigns and of large land forces don't think in chronological terms. They think in terms of the mission against a particular enemy, the organization of their forces on the ground, the time it takes to get their forces in a posture to accomplish their mission on that terrain, and at the least cost to their own side. Sometimes they will think in terms of hours to accomplish all this, sometimes in terms of days. Sometimes the mission will take hours, sometimes it will take days. In other words, during Desert Storm, I did not think in terms of discrete days. On the first day, on the 24th, when we were ordered to attack early, I was thinking in the present. We had lots to do to pull that off. But I was also thinking 2 days in advance. I knew that decisions I would make that first day would influence the posture the Corps could get into on the third day, the 26th. About midnight, I told Toby, Major Toby Martinez, to wake me for anything significant, then left the enclosed area and went to get some rest. Stan and most of the TAC team were still at it when I left. At 0500 on the 25th, I was awake and back at it. A quick paper cup of coffee, a few moments to strap on my leg and the other boot, shoulder holster, and Kevlar, then a short walk over to the TAC CP. The charcoal-lined chemical protective overgarment we all wore felt good in the early morning cold. Stan Cherry and the TAC team were already in there, and radios were already alive with reports. 0600, 7th Corps, TAC CP, Saudi Arabia. 25 February 1991. During the very brief, less than 20-minute morning update, the G2 went quickly over the enemy situation. Then Stan reviewed the battle activity since midnight. Our units reported more prisoners. The early indicators showed the Republican Guards were making some attempt at reorientation. But at this point, it seemed to me they still believed the main attack was coming north up the wadi. Throughout all this, I was both thinking and listening, redoing my mental map of enemy and friendly units based on the briefing. I was also thinking of where I needed to go that morning to get information or to confirm what I already had. Right now, I was getting maybe 20% of my input from my staff at the CP, 40 to 50% from what I was seeing and hearing myself and from my commanders as I met them, and the rest came from my own professional knowledge, training, education, and combat experience. I had to get on the move, and I needed to talk to my commanders face to face. But I was going nowhere right now. High winds and blowing sand, which reduced visibility to a few hundred meters, had grounded us. I used the delay to talk to John Yosik. John dropped some surprising news on me. The SYNC was concerned that we were not moving fast enough. For a moment, that hit me hard. It takes a lot of wind out of your sails when your theater commander seems disappointed in your progress. My first thought was defensive. We had done well even to have gotten where we were this morning, given the 15-hour advance start, I said to John. You know what we've been doing and why. When John told me that, in fact, he thought we were doing fine, I decided not to give the SYNC's concerns much more thought at the time. It looks like they don't have a good picture of the core situation in Riyadh, I told myself, and when they do, this will blow over. After the war, I was to find out that John had been shielding me from an extraordinary emotional outburst from General Schwarzkopf during his morning update. He had, I have gathered from later reports, hit the ceiling. He had expected a 7th Corps cavalry charge to the Republican Guards, and when he didn't get it, he blew up into one of his well-publicized rages. Since John Yosik had much more experience with large armored maneuvers than Schwarzkopf, he knew that the SYNC's expectations were illusory. He toned down the SYNC's blow-up to concerns when we talked that morning. Later commentators, including General Schwarzkopf, have claimed that from virtually the first moments of the G-Day attack, the U.S. Army should have been in pursuit mode rather than in what we call movement to contact. More bluntly, they have accused 7th Corps of failing to go into pursuit when we should have. However, you go into pursuit when your enemy is in retreat or fleeing. Though that's what Iraqi units elsewhere were doing, that was not the case with the Republican Guards. They were setting up a defense. Even if the SYNC had told us to go into pursuit, which he did not do, it would have been a mistake. His concern should have been to isolate and cut off the Republican Guards, mostly by air, so that 7th Corps and 18th Corps could destroy them. Instead, he flew into a rage about how fast we were going, based on blue lines on a map in Riyadh that probably were not even accurately posted. Because we were co-located with the 3rd Armored Division, Butch Funk took the opportunity to come see me. When he came into the CP at 0725, I had two things on my mind. I wanted to keep him moving toward the Republican Guards, but I also wanted him to continue protecting our right flank from stray Iraqi units or vehicles until the British got out there in force. Butch rogered that. After my talk with Butch, I had a few minutes to myself. Before I went out to visit commanders, I wanted to take a hard look at our primary mission and our tactics. I wanted to be as certain as I possibly could that what we were about to do would destroy the Republican Guards. I had not considered any maneuver except to aim 7th Corps directly at that force. I wanted to maneuver 7th Corps into a position from which we could not only attack them, but pile on. If I decided on Frag Plan 7, I wanted a 3-division moving fist of reasonably fresh troops at Collins, with enough fuel to sustain the attack until the Republican Guards were destroyed. I wanted a rolling attack right into them. No pauses. Therefore, I adjusted the tempo during the first 2 days to meet that goal. When Butch left the TAC, the weather had cleared enough for me to fly forward. About 08:30, though the wind had slowed down enough to fly, the sky was overcast and the temperature was 50 degrees. First, I went forward to meet Ron Griffith. If the Republican guards stayed fixed, we were in an excellent position to turn 90 degrees east with our main attack, Frag Plan 7. I felt it more important than ever for Ron to move 1st Armored Division fast to Objective Purple, the town of Al-Busayya, and achieve a positional advantage on the northwest flank of the Republican Guards in case they came toward us. With that done, I wanted him to be in the northern part of Objective Collins by mid-morning the next day. Ron was clearly on top of the situation and feeling good about his operation. I could see it on his face and hear it in his tone of voice. In fact, he reported their main problem so far wasn't the Iraqi army, but the Iraqi terrain in the forward parts of their sector. They had encountered boulder fields, sabquas, soft sand, and blowing sand on the previous day, which had made it difficult to maintain unit integrity and had caused them to consume more fuel than they had anticipated. Fuel vehicles had gotten stuck in the sand, and some rocky terrain had proved more difficult to get through in coherent formations than we had thought. The Iraqis had read it the same way. Thus, not only did the Iraqis not occupy it, they thought it would help their defense refuse the left flank. Once through this area, the 1st Armored Division tempo picked up dramatically. Meanwhile, in order to maintain the momentum of his attack, Ron was about to shift the division formation out of its wedge. What he wanted to do was destroy the brigade of the 26th Division that had been out there refusing the flank, while he bypassed with the other two brigades and moved rapidly to Al-Busayya. Al-Busayya was a key in our planning. It was the major Iraqi 7th Corps logistics base, and an airfield was nearby. After 1st Armored Division took it, 3rd Army planned to use this area as a logistics base for 18th Corps and to push supplies up to 18th Corps through the 1st Armored Division zone. Getting it also secured 18th Corps' flank. I told Ron Griffith to clear the zone of all Iraqi combat units, which he did. Al-Busayya was a significant battle. Ron attacked it with his 2nd Brigade and bypassed with the rest of the division so that they would arrive in Collins to the east by mid-morning of the 26th, as I had ordered. After I left Ron Griffith, I flew about 40 kilometers to the jump tack. They had no word on the release of 1st Cav, no change of mission from 3rd Army, and no change in intel from what I had gotten a few hours earlier. At this point, I made a decision. 1st Infantry would be the 3rd Division in our fist. Now I needed to get them free of the breach and forward behind the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. About 1100, I flew the 40 to 50 kilometers to link up with Tom Rahm and Rupert Smith. As we flew in, I could see evidence of success all around. Specifically, the 1st Infantry had pushed their 3rd Brigade forward in between their 1st and 2nd Brigades as they expanded left, right, and forward. I could see overrun Iraqi positions and destroyed Iraqi equipment. I also could see a steady movement of 1st Infantry vehicles forward into the newly expanded breachhead area to make room for the British passage. Their biggest challenge, I knew, was handling the thousands of prisoners. Tom Rahm came out to greet me, cigar in hand, obviously animated. Rupert Smith was there as well, clearly ready and eager to get his division into the fight. "Boss, this operation is going great," Tom began. "We've pushed out, and Rupert is beginning his passage." Tom went on to report that they had destroyed all of the Iraqi 26th Division which had been facing them. Tom was really pumped, and I think a bit relieved that the breach had gone so well and at such a small cost. He was proud of his troops, and rightfully so. As he finished, he added, with the same enthusiasm with which he had made his report, "Don't leave us behind, boss." "No chance of that." Then I told him what I'd come to tell him. that the Big Red One was to become the 3rd Division in our fist. I want you to leave a task force, a battalion, in the breach for security, and after 1st UK passes, move your division forward here. Pointing to the map, I gave Tom a location I had picked, just south and west of the place where 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment would be by that time. Be prepared to make a forward passage through 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment sometime late tomorrow afternoon to attack the Republican Guards. Tom said, Wilco. He was not one to waste words. Meanwhile, the British had been moving forward most of the day before and into the night to an area just south of the border berm. Rupert, what I've just told Tom means your division must move through here as quickly as possible and clear out so that Tom can move forward. Rupert told me that he saw no problems and that he and Tom would stay in communications and make it happen. After I left Rupert and Tom, I huddled for a few minutes at my other jump tack, which was at the breach. While I was there, I got a flash report from the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. At 12:40, they reported that they'd found the security area of the Tawakana Division and identified the unit as the 50th Brigade of the 12th Armored Division. The security area is a zone of about 15 to 20 kilometers, sometimes less, in front of a main defense, and is intended to deceive the attacker as to the location of the main defense and to break up the momentum of the attacking force by causing them to fight, deploy, and thus expose their intentions early. Finding the Republican Guard security area was a big deal for me, for it indicated that our main attack was beginning. Once that zone had been found, I wanted 1st Cav to attack through it and into the main defense. My orders to 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment were to press on to develop the situation, but not to become decisively engaged. I did not want them stuck in a situation they could not handle while I was maneuvering the heavy fist of the Corps against the Iraqis' main defense area. By now it was getting close to 1400, time to go forward and get a first-hand, face-to-face assessment from Don Holder. By 15:30, I was at the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment main CP. I could tell from Don Holder's voice and his eyes that he was in a fight. I also sensed he had it firmly under control and needed no additional help from Corps assets at this point. From all these battle events, the regiment's intelligence assessment and Don's judgment was that the Tawakana Division was along the 65 easting, about 20 kilometers east of our phase line smash, covering the Iraqi army's withdrawal from Kuwait, and with a security zone that extended 8 kilometers west. That battlefield report and Don's judgment confirmed the conditions for Frag Plan 7. So far, 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment's mission had been to protect the movement of the main body from enemy action, and Don and the regiment had been adjusting their tempo to stay about 30 minutes in front of the main body. Now, that was about to change. I ordered Don on a reconnaissance mission, part of an offensive cover, which meant that he now had to orient himself more directly on the enemy in front of him than on the Corps behind him. It also meant that the movement tempo could change. That is, he was no longer restricted to keeping about 30 minutes ahead of the lead elements of the rest of the Corps. Don and the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment were now focused on the enemy, while at the same time estimating a place where they could pass the 1st Infantry through. After a quick look at Frag Plan 7 on the map, I looked ahead at both 3rd Armored Division and 1st Infantry in relation to the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. We needed to pass both divisions through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment to take up the fight against the Tawakana and the developing Republican Guards defense. But the two divisions were in different circumstances. The 3rd Armored Division was immediately available to execute and was to the west-southwest of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment by about 30 minutes to an hour, just about right. On the other hand, the 1st Infantry was in the breach about 60 to 80 kilometers away from the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment and fixed in place until the British could pass through. But it was all coming together. I knew what I wanted to do. I would use Frag Plan 7, but with the 1st Infantry in place of the 1st Cav, who were still held in CENTCOM reserve. With the decision came an assumption. Since the Tawakana was fixed, the other two Republican Guards' heavy divisions, Medina and Hammurabi, would also doubtless fight in that defense. I left Don and flew about 40 kilometers to the southwest to a spot in the desert where my jump TAC was being co-located with the 3rd Armored Division TAC-CP. The sky was dark and the wind was picking up. It looked like rain. In the fast-fading daylight, we huddled around a Humvee hood with a map spread over the top. The jump TAC was still setting up. John Davidson, the G2, began. The Republican Guard situation is about what we reported to you this morning. The way it looks, the Republican Guards will defend from where they are now. That was the final intelligence piece I needed, which confirmed everything I'd learned at the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. That does it. We execute Frag Plan 7. Get the orders out. I want 1st Infantry to pass through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment and continue the attack tomorrow afternoon. I want 3rd Armored Division to pass through and around to the north of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment and attack east. I already told Ron Griffith I want him in the northern part of Collins by mid-morning tomorrow to attack east from there. 7th Corps would now turn 90 degrees east and activate the new 3rd Army northern boundary between us and 18th Corps, which would open an attack lane for them and make possible the mutually supporting corps attacks I thought we needed. It also meant that the Republican Guards were now in two sectors, ours and 18th Corps. I knew I needed to call John Yosik right away to tell him what we were doing. Getting hold of him did not prove to be easy.
Meanwhile, many other things were going on in the theater of operations. On Monday morning, 25 February, this was the state of affairs in the Iraqi-occupied emirate that the Iraqis called Al Burqan Province and everyone else called Kuwait. The Marines were in possession of the better part of the Kuwaiti boot heel, 20 to 40 kilometers into the Iraqi defense. In the process of taking it, they had mauled 3 Iraqi divisions and captured 8,000 Iraqi prisoners. JFC North, to their west, with only enough breaching equipment to open 11 lanes, had not by then made much of a dent in Iraqi lines. Even so, though they were deliberate, the Egyptians were getting the job done. And on the coast, the forces of JFC East had advanced steadily, though not especially speedily, toward Kuwait City. The Iraqis in Kuwait were in a wretched condition, and that was just fine as far as the Marines and the Arabs fighting them were concerned. At least 5 frontline Iraqi divisions were, for all practical purposes, no longer in existence, and several other divisions, including some heavies, were so severely battered they were close to ineffective. In the end, the Iraqis in Kuwait proved more efficient at destruction and looting than at organizing a defense and fighting a determined, well-trained foe. Most notably, the Iraqis sabotaged refineries and more than 150 oil wells. Black, greasy plumes of smoke darkened the skies over Kuwait. The rest of G+1 was not to go so smoothly. Early that morning in Kuwait, T-55 tanks from the Iraqi 3rd Corps attacked the eastern flank of the 1st Marine Division out of the oil smoke-grimed fog covering the Burqan oil field. It was a sharp battle. Perhaps the largest tank engagement in Marine history. The poorly trained Iraqis were no match for the Marines with their M60 tanks, their LAVs, light armored vehicles, their Cobra attack helicopters, and their Harrier fighter bombers, not to mention TOWs and other missiles. As it happened, the Iraqi defeat was not a total loss for them. It bought time. The battle put an end to the Marine advance for the rest of the day, and this gave major elements of the Iraqi army time to pull out of Kuwait City. That afternoon, 1,000 paratroopers from the 101st Airborne's 3rd Brigade were lifted by Blackhawks north to a spot in the Euphrates Valley near the town of Al-Qadir. Because the weather was so grim, Colonel Robert Clark, the brigade commander, decided to hold off on reinforcing the 1,000 who had already landed. That left a lightly armed force of paratroopers to spend the very cold, wet night between G+1 and G+2, setting up ambush positions to close off Highway 8 and waiting nervously for Iraqi armor to counterattack. The Iraqi armor, blessedly, never showed up. The worst the Americans had to face, as it happened, were 15 Iraqi infantrymen, whom they drove off with mortars. Later, they stopped a convoy whose trucks turned out to be carrying onions, which they gave to hungry local villagers the next day. Though the 101st's hold on Highway 8 was then tenuous, they were soon reinforced, and their hold proved real, lasting, and effective. For the rest of the war, if the Iraqis wanted to drive from Basra to Baghdad, they didn't do it on Highway 8.
7th Corps Jump Tech in Iraq. At 1800, I got a call from Ron Griffith. He was in a situation that would delay his attack into Al-Busayya. His G2 had estimated that an Iraqi commando battalion, tank company, and some other infantry were in Al-Busayya, all positioned to protect the 7th Iraqi Corps logistics base. The area around Al-Busayya was laced with 4 to 6 foot deep wadis, and the Iraqi tanks were dispersed and dug into the terrain, as was the infantry. The commando battalion was in the town itself, 30 to 35 buildings of stone and thick adobe. Because Ron preferred not to get into a night fight that would set his mounted units against dismounted enemy troops, he wanted my okay to hold his mounted ground attack until first light the next day. I figured the tactics were up to Ron, but the core tempo was my business. My main core focus for Ron was that he have the 1st Armored Division in Collins the next morning at 0900. It made no sense to risk the casualties and possible fratricide that could result from a mounted attack at night into a dismounted defense in a village. So I told him, "Permission granted. As long as you are in the northern part of Collins by 0900, attacking east beside 3rd Armored Division." Meanwhile, we were getting reports that the British had had enemy contact right after noon. The entire division was still not clear of the breach. This was not good news, as it would delay the 1st Infantry move north to pass through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. I heard from my chief of staff, John Landry, that we had no additional orders from 3rd Army, but he had learned there was still concern about the 7th Corps pace of attack. That really got my attention. I blew up over the phone to John. "What the hell is wrong with them in Riyadh? Do they know what the hell is going on out here? I've talked to John Yosik continually to let him know what's happening. Here we are maneuvering the Corps to get in position for the knockout of the Republican Guards, and they are concerned about progress? God damn it!" I let the moment pass. I thought the concerns in Riyadh also would pass when they had a clearer picture. But I also thought that I'd better find out what the problem was. I told Landry I'd call John Yosik later and talk to him about it. The other issue was our deep attack. I had wanted to attack deep with the 11th Aviation Brigade the previous night, but because of the time change of the core attack, we hadn't been able to execute. Tonight, I wanted them to go deep in front of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment to help isolate the Iraqis in the battle space. At around 1800, the weather turned bad. Our communications were terrible. We talked through Frag Plan 7 again that evening. At about 2100, I went over to Butch Funk's tack so I could get an update. There, I ordered Frag Plan 7 and used Butch's comms to get John Yosik. "John, I ordered the Corps to turn right according to our Frag Plan 7. That activates the boundary between us and 18th Corps to run east-west and opens the attack corridor for 18th Corps in the north for a 2-Corps attack. I am using 1st Infantry as my 3rd Division in the 7th Corps fist. I assume all this is okay with you." "Good," John replied. "Continue to attack. You're doing exactly as I want done." That confirmed for me that we were doing precisely what we had discussed and wargamed and what 3rd Army had published in its orders of 24 February. "John, my chief mentioned there might be some continuing dissatisfaction with Corps movement. Not from me. But the sink blew up this morning. He thought you should be moving faster. Don't you know what the hell is going on? I said. I was frustrated that they did not seem to have a grasp that we had maneuvered the Corps to deliver a death blow to the Republican Guards. We are turning the Corps 90 degrees east into the Republican Guards and will hit them with a three-division fist tomorrow. I thought we were doing great, considering the number of units and vehicles we've got crammed into this small maneuver space. John replied, I'm aware of all that, and I understand everything you're trying to do. You have the best feel for the situation, Fred. I'm pleased with what 7th Corps is doing. Would it do any good for me to talk directly to General Schwarzkopf and explain what we're doing? I was not yet satisfied that the concerns issue had been laid to rest. John said, Settle down, Fred. It's okay now. The sink is satisfied with what is happening. He doesn't want the pace any faster now. He's concerned with fratricide if the pace gets too fast. So his intent is for deliberate operations with low casualties. Right now, the sink wants us to fight smart, deliberately, with small casualties, develop the situation, and fix by fires. That's good to hear. But I did think that if I talked to Schwarzkopf, I could give him some direct info from the battlefield. I knew that I would have appreciated a call from the actual battlefield if I were in his place. Do you still think I should talk to the sink? Good idea. Go ahead and talk to him, probably tomorrow. All that night, out in the rainy, windy desert ahead of us and for dozens of kilometers on either side, commanders of smaller units were organizing their forces and maneuvering their teams in such a way that their piece of the Corps fist would hit the enemy with maximum impact. While you are arranging and maneuvering, you can never lose sight of physical friction. Armored formations have to refuel and rearm, which takes time. They have to repair vehicles with maintenance problems and perform preventive maintenance. Meanwhile, different vehicles move at different speeds. Tanks go much faster than artillery vehicles. So in an attack, you have to make sure that one doesn't outrun the other. Fuel trucks also are slower than tanks and Bradleys cross country. Movement at night is much slower than in the day. Soldier fatigue also affects speed. If you're standing in turrets or lying in driver's compartments for a long time, you get tired and lose concentration. You must give the men breaks from time to time. At around 0100, I went back to the 7th Corps jump taxi P to see if there'd been any change while I was gone. The rain and high winds continued, and the soldiers were wet and cold. Though the bad weather had caused cancellation of our deep aviation attack, other actions continued. A little after 0100, I decided to get some rest. It was a short night. Toby shook me awake at about 0400 with some black coffee he had scrounged up from somewhere. My sleep had probably been longer and more comfortable than what most of the soldiers in 7th Corps had gotten. Many were in combat. Others were refueling and doing maintenance. Commanders were collecting units, planning for their next move, and looking to execute their part of Frag Plan 7. Today, we would hit the Tawakana and subordinate units hard. Meanwhile, as we turned 90 degrees east, I also wanted to keep track of the progress of 18th Corps. If their attack east did not move at the pace of ours, Ron Griffith and the 1st Armored Division would have an open flank. Our own situation was still good. The British 1st Armored Division had completed its passage of lines through the 1st Infantry at about 0300. 1st Infantry had left a task force in the breach and were just now beginning to move forward to get into position to pass through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. 1st Armored Division had pounded Al-Busayah for the rest of the night and were about to attack to seize it. 3rd Armored Division was poised to pass around the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment to the north and slam due east into the Tawakana. 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment had spent the remainder of the night in an active horseshoe defense astride an Iraqi main supply route. They were there in position to stop Iraqi units from using that route out of Kuwait, either to join the Tawakana's defense against our attack or to escape the theater. Though I was a little surprised to see that the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment had not moved forward during the night to maintain pressure, they weren't sitting on their hands. Today they were moving out to gain and maintain contact, to pass 3rd Armored Division to their north, and to be prepared at some point to pass the 1st Infantry through. The reports to Riyadh, meanwhile, lagged well behind many of these actions, and once or twice they were downright wrong. At 0800, I called John Yosik to give him a report on the progress of our maneuver, and to tell him that I expected the Corps to be in contact with the Tawakana that morning, and that I would pass the 1st Infantry through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment to continue the attack later that day. After I delivered the basic facts, I continued to voice my frustration at the apparent lack of a common picture of the battlefield between Riyadh and the field. He himself understood what we were trying to do, John explained. However, the sink had gotten heated up again that morning about the pace of our attack. Then, to top it off, John wanted me to order the British to attack south in order to clear the Wadi al-Batin area from the Saudi border north into Kuwait. I didn't like that idea at all, and I said so strongly. We had come out west so that we could avoid all the mines and obstacles the Iraqis had put up in the Wadi. Why in the hell would we go in there now? Once we had worked our way through that issue, I asked if and when the 1st cab would be released. Sometime today, John answered. And to us. John's attitude had undergone a distinct change from the time of my call to him the night before to today. The night before, we were doing okay. The sink's intent was for us to conduct a deliberate attack to minimize casualties. Now there was abruptly a greater urgency, a change I was not to understand until long after the war. In a student monograph at the U.S. Army's War College at Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, Colonel Mike Kendall unraveled some of the knots that had long puzzled me. He explained to me that at 0215 hours on 26 February, the sink was awakened by Brigadier General Neal, his night operations officer, with a report that the Iraqis had ordered their units out of Kuwait City. The sink talked to General Powell and expressed concern that a ceasefire could occur within 2 days, resulting in the escape of the Republican Guards. Generals Schwarzkopf and Powell now believed that the 7th Corps would have to speed up the attack against the Republican Guards if there was any hope of destroying them. And yet, because Yosik was aware that there was no way to make the Corps go faster, he simply told me to keep pressing the attack. At 0730, en route to the 1st Armored Division, I got a report that Dragoon reported contact with Republican Guards, Tawakana Division. Dragoon was the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. That was a big report. It confirmed what I had been expecting. We had them fixed, and we were going to attack and hit them hard and keep hitting them until they were finished. At 0800, as I approached 1st Armored Division, I was thinking that I needed to make clear what I wanted done today and my continued intentions. In light of this report confirming the location of the Tawakana, I wanted to be sure that the 1st Armored Division and all my commanders understood my intent. No pauses in front of the Republican Guards. I greeted Ron with the news of the Republican Guards' contact to his south. The attack on Albusayo was going well, he reported. He would finish it with one brigade and would be in the northern part of Collins with the other two brigades to continue the attack by late morning. I gave him essentially the same order I had given to Butch Funk earlier. Ron, I want you to press the fight all day. Do not stop. Continue the attack all day and into tonight. Ron was a strong commander and knew what he had to do. He would make it happen. I returned to the TAC FWD, about 30 kilometers away. By now, the 3rd Armored Division had moved out to execute its maneuver east around the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment and attack the Tawakana. At 10:00, Tom Rahm showed up. I wanted to know when he and the 1st Infantry would be ready to take the fight from the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. Tom gave me a quick sit-rep on his progress. He said, "Boss, we began movement at 04:30 as soon as the British cleared, and we're now moving forward in the worst sandstorm I've ever seen. We'll be set on Phase Line Hearts before dark." Phase Line Hearts was about 20 kilometers west of Phase Line Smash. That was much slower than I had expected, but it was real. I knew Tom wasn't making excuses. Friction is everywhere. You have to deal with it. You can't wish it away. I told him I wanted him to pass through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment and continue the attack through the Tawakana and deep into the Iraqi stiffening defenses. Tom left to make it happen. Later, I got a call from my main CP. At 09:30, the 1st Cav had been released from CENTCOM Reserve to 7th Corps. John Tolelli used his initiative and called me right away. He said, "We've been chopped to 7th Corps. Roger, welcome back to the team. I want you to move your division as fast as you can to Area Lee. We are executing Frag Plan 7 and have just hit the Republican Guards. 1st Infantry will pass through 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment later today and attack east. Depending on how our attack goes today and tonight, I will commit you either around to the south of the 1st Infantry or around to the north of the 1st Armored Division. Too soon to call. Wilco, we're on the move." Even though he had still been under the command of CENTCOM, John had been thinking ahead and had tentative plans and was ready to execute them. By late morning, true to his earlier assurances, Ron Griffith had the 1st Armored Division in the northern part of Collins and was attacking east. Meanwhile, Butch Funk had maneuvered the 3rd Armored Division into two brigades forward, the 2nd on the left and the 1st on the right, with his 3rd Brigade in reserve. By a little after 09:00, he was passing north of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. We now had a giant left hook forming, with the 1st Armored Division coming around on the outside, 3rd Armored Division in the center, and 1st Infantry coming up on the right to take over from 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. We would hit the forming Republican Guard defense from south to north with a force the likes of which they had never imagined. All in all, it was an impressive display of teamwork. Everyone doing the little things to reduce friction without being told. Around noon, I flew over to 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment to see how much farther to push them into the Republican Guards and to learn if they had found the Republican Guard's southern flank. I was still thinking of passing 1st Infantry forward during the daylight, a much easier move than a night passage and less risky for fratricide. At 12:50, I arrived at the Dragoon Tack and got a quick sit-rep from Don Holder and Steve Robinette. The Iraqis were in defensive positions. There were numerous reports of dug-in tanks, battalion defensive positions, some artillery fire. They might not be as skillful as they could have been because we had not given them time to set a defense, but they were not running away, not here, and not in 1st or 3rd Armored Division sectors. Now to the question of where to make the passage with the 1st Infantry. We estimated that the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment could go another 10 kilometers before they would be ready for the 1st Infantry to begin passage. That meant the 1st Infantry would roll into an area about 20 kilometers to the rear, take care of coordination, then move forward and make the passage. At 13:25 at 7th Corps TAC FWD, 1st Infantry's arrival estimates had been pushed back even further, but the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment was still doing well, continuing the attack with no problem. With that, at 14:00, I returned to the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, who by then had engaged in a major battle with the Tawakana. Three things helped the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment troopers: the boldness of their small unit leaders, the training of their soldiers, and the weather. They attacked in a sandstorm. The Iraqis never saw what hit them until it was too late. The Iraqis were in what is called a reverse slope defense, a tactic they had used successfully against Iran. Taking advantage of the normal 50 to 100-foot undulations in the rolling desert, they had positioned part of a unit on the leading edge of a rise in the desert floor, while the remainder of the unit was concealed on the other side of the rise, or on the reverse slope. Their intent was to lure unsuspecting attackers into believing that they had to contend with only the small unit on the forward slope. But when the attackers came over the rise, they would be hit by volley fire from the rest of the Iraqi defenders on the other side. It had been a good tactic against the Iranians. It did not work against our troops. In addition to the reverse slope defense, the Iraqis had some other devices. In some places, though not much in this engagement, they placed 55-gallon drums out in front that could be heated at night and used as target reference points for their infrared night sight equipment. They sometimes also, but not in this engagement, put out burning rubber tires to decoy laser-guided bombs or heat-seeking target designators away from their real targets. In other words, the Iraqis were doing the best they could. But on this day, the weather was particularly bad, with visibility in the hundreds of meters, if that. The Iraqis never thought anyone would attack them in that kind of weather. Captain H.R. McMaster, Troop E commander, offers this account. "I was issuing final instructions to the troop when my tank crested another almost imperceptible rise. As we came over the top, my gunner, Staff Sergeant Koch, yelled, 'Tanks, direct front!' I counted 8 tanks in dug-in positions on the back slope of the ridge. Koch hit the button on the laser rangefinder and the display showed 1,420 meters. I yelled, 'Fire! Fire, Sabot!' The enemy tank's turret separated from its hull in a hail of sparks. In 23 minutes, Eagle Troop had reduced the enemy position to a spectacular array of burning vehicles." Captain Dan Miller, Troop 1 commander, gives this report. "Enemy tank turrets were hurled skyward as 120-millimeter Sabot rounds ripped through the T-55 and T-72 tanks. The fireballs that followed hurled debris 100 feet into the air. Secondary explosions destroyed the vehicles beyond recognition. The annihilation of this Iraqi armor battalion continued when the troop found itself surrounded by burning hulls and exploding ammo bunkers. The report of advancing T-72s from the east told us the battle wasn't over. 7 T-72s had managed to crawl out of their riveted positions and attempt a counterattack. The flash from their gun tubes confirmed they had a fix on us. At 2,100 meters, the inferior T-72 didn't stand a chance against the Abrams M1A1. The depleted uranium long-rod penetrators from the Sabot round passed through the T-72s like a hot knife through butter. The TOW missiles also had no problem with the range on penetration, and the counterattack was squelched like a match in a cup of water. We lost one vehicle in the armor battle, but thankfully the crew all survived." The Battle of 73 Easting proved to be a watershed event for our 7th Corps attack, and in the longer run, for the U.S. Army. For the Army, it was a vindication and microcosm of all our emphasis on tough, performance-oriented training at the National Training Center. For 7th Corps, the battle was critical because the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment not only succeeded in collapsing the security zone of the developing Iraqi defense, but delivered a resounding defeat to the Tawakana 1st Echelon and kept the Iraqis off balance until we got the 1st Infantry into the fight. After I flew the short distance to the TAC, which was now set up at our new location, I still had to make the decision on the Big Red One. Should I pass them forward at night or wait until morning? I weighed the pluses and minuses once again, then made my decision. I needed the 1st Infantry combat power attacking the now stunned defense before they could recover. At 1700 hours, I called Tom Rahm and ordered him to pass through. It was a heavy decision for me. I knew what I was asking the soldiers and leaders to do.
G plus 2, the rest of the theater. For the first 24 hours after their launch on G-Day, 18th Corps' powerful 24th Mech had relatively easy going, with virtually no enemy opposition over hard desert highlands as they thrust north toward Highway 8 and the Euphrates. But then, about 60 kilometers south of the highway, the terrain sloped down toward the river and turned into nearly impenetrable quagmires. After they got through the bog, the 24th MEC took aim at two airfields and the highway itself. By early evening of the 26th, 2nd Brigade was in position to attack Djaliba, and by early morning of the following day, 197th Brigade had fought another 300 Republican Guard commandos in the vicinity of Talil Airfield and secured a position southeast of the field. The 24th Division spent the morning of the 27th attacking the airfield. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Gary Luck ordered 18th Corps to attack east into the Republican Guards. The 24th MEC and the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment would be the main effort, attacking east along Highway 8 late on the 27th. 18th Corps was now prepared to synchronize its operations with 7th Corps, but they had to hurry. 7th Corps was at least 50 kilometers farther east than Gary Luck's easternmost unit, and the gap between the two corps was growing. Over in Kuwait, on the night of 25-26 February, there began an episode that would later turn out to be a major reason why the war ended early. Late on the evening of the 25th, the Kuwaiti resistance let the Saudis know that the Iraqi army in Kuwait City appeared to be forming convoys out of military and civilian vehicles. Something approaching 200 vehicles was tracked moving on the freeway connecting Kuwait City and Basra near the town of Al-Jarrah at the western end of the Bay of Kuwait. Soon, Navy and Air Force F-15s were attacking these vehicles. Close to 1,500 smashed and burned-out hulks clogged the road to Basra. An article appeared in the 26 February Washington Post entitled, "Like Fish in a Barrel, U.S. Pilots Say." Another appeared the same day describing coalition air attacks as a combat frenzy. Such views, half a world from the action, were about to set in motion decisions that would determine whether or not Norman Schwarzkopf's imperative, destroy the Republican Guards, would in fact be achieved. By the afternoon of the 26th, the 2nd Marine Division had cut off the highway to Basra, while the 1st Marine Division had sealed off the Kuwait International Airport. Kuwait City was now encircled.
That evening, the activity level was high in the 7th Corps TAC CP. With enormous effort, the staff had traveled 150 kilometers to a position just west and north of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment 73 Easting Battle, set up the five M577 command post vehicles, and reestablished the communication channels. By now, the sandstorms, limited visibility, and rain of the late afternoon had passed us by. We had been in a fight with the Republican Guards since noon the day before. I asked Stan to assemble the TAC crew so that I could brief them about what had gone on that day and outline what I had in mind for the next 7th Corps maneuver. I told them, "For the next 24 to 36 hours, we are going to drive the Corps hard, day and night, to overcome all resistance and to prevent the enemy from withdrawing. We will synchronize our fight, as we always have, but we will crank up the heat. The way home is through the Republican Guards." At around 18:30, I called CENTCOM headquarters and asked for General Schwarzkopf, but he was not in. They told me he would call back, and we finally connected sometime before 20:00. Since I have no exact notes on this call, this was the gist. I'd wondered if he would raise the issue of the speed of our advance, but he didn't, which pleased me. It seemed to indicate that the issue was closed. I began by reporting that we had turned the Corps 90 degrees east and were attacking the Republican Guards, that 1st Infantry would pass through 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment that night and form the three-division fist of the Corps to destroy the Republican Guards, that I had Apaches going deep that night, and that we were pressing the fight hard. He seemed to take it all in. After I had taken him through our basic situation, I told him about our orders from the 3rd Army to attack south with the British, and told him that instead we should continue east and maybe north with the British, and he agreed. He thought going south was a bad idea as well. Once again, I thought we understood each other. Again, I discovered after the war that I was wrong. In his autobiography, General Schwarzkopf reports that he heard me say that I was worried about some bypassed Iraqi units that might hit us in the flank, and that I wanted them destroyed before our forces turned to the Republican Guards, and therefore I was about to order an attack toward the south. Schwarzkopf writes that he replied to me, "Fred, for Christ's sakes, don't turn south, turn east. Go after them." A few lines later, Schwarzkopf chalked it up to understandable pre-battle jitters. But what he seemed to be saying was that I intended to have the whole corps attack south before I got around to hitting the Republican Guards. Such a thought couldn't have been further from my mind. I didn't even want to attack south with the British, much less the whole corps. How he got that impression is almost unimaginable to me. Lastly, I told him about our commitment of the 1st Cav in the north and our double envelopment scheme of maneuver. After he had listened to it all, he answered, "Okay, Fred, good work, and keep it up," or words to that effect. Then he added some intelligence that was new to me. The Hammurabi Division were being loaded onto HETs and were trying to escape the theater. My sense of urgency increased. Finally, he thanked me for the update, added a good luck. I could not help but conclude that he was satisfied with what we were doing. He also left me with the feeling that we had maybe another 48 hours to finish this war. I called John Yosik to report the conversation and my impressions, and also told him that I had raised the issue of the British attacking south, and that the Senk had agreed that it was not a good idea. John then released me from it. In all fairness to John, the mission south had not been a stupid or ill-considered idea. In addition to the possibility of getting the 1st Cav into the fight earlier, he had also been thinking that by clearing the area, he could more quickly establish a log base in Kuwait that would give us a much faster turnaround time for fuel, in case we and the 18th Corps continued fighting in and around northern Kuwait and near Basra. During the day, our main CP had been developing a clear picture of the Iraqis' activities. And after my phone calls, our G2 folks gave Stan and me a quick intelligence update. I put the intel update together with the information my commanders had given me during my battlefield visits earlier that day, and they matched. From there, my commander's running estimate led me to these conclusions. I knew we had the Iraqi forces fixed. We had also surprised them with the speed and direction of our attack, and they were now scrambling to reorient and to thicken the defense. I needed to continue to press the core attack so that the Iraqis could not get any more set than they already were. We had opened up a window of vulnerability in the Iraqi defense, and we needed to complete our mission before that window closed. As for us, it was clear to me again that we had the right forces in the right combination at the right place at the right time. The decision to mass into a 3-division fist, the changes in tempo, the rolling attack, all were proving correct. But it would not be easy. For the soldiers and small unit commanders conducting the attacks, it would turn out to be a night we would all remember. Earlier that afternoon, even while paying attention to the current battles, I had been intermittently thinking about the next move. With confirmed locations and intentions for the Republican Guard units, I began shaping a plan for a double envelopment. Initially, I intended to use the 1st UK Armor as the southern pincer and the recently released and on-the-move 1st Cav as the northern pincer. The double envelopment was going to be our next major maneuver. Most of the orders would be oral, and there would be some hastily drawn boundaries. These would be all we would need. By now, we were a veteran corps. By late afternoon of 26 February, we had 3 divisions and a cavalry regiment in direct contact with the enemy. North to south, 1st Armored Division, 3rd Armored Division, 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, and 1st UK. The 1st Infantry Division had been moving since 04:30 and would pass forward through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment later that evening to give us 4 divisions online in a night attack. By this time, with so many units engaged in combat, There were more events to report in the battle than time to report them. The best we could do for our higher headquarters was to summarize our plans and the enemy actions. At every level, commanders and soldiers were more focused on fighting their units than on reporting, and so the latter suffered. Little of the intensity of these battles was getting reported to Third Army or CENTCOM. From all I've read since the war, it seems that the impression in Riyadh was that the Republican Guards battle would really start on the 27th. But in fact, we had been in the Republican Guards attack since noon on the 25th. I did make a short phone call to John Yosik to give him an accurate description of our maneuvers and to inform him that we were in contact with the Republican Guards. But I did not go into details about the fighting or the enemy destroyed. I didn't know many of them myself at the time. Since General Schwarzkopf never called me directly or came out to see for himself, he did not have a complete picture of the 7th Corps situation. I was not to find out how flawed that picture was until much later. Once I had completed the forecasting and had put the next day's operation into motion, I turned my attention back to our current attack. Three things were on my mind. First, I wanted to maintain its momentum, yet I also wanted all my commanders to be aware of the rising risk of fratricide as we maneuvered three U.S. armored divisions abreast to conduct a night attack. Second, I wanted to pass the 1st Infantry through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. The 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment was skillful in these maneuvers and would take steps to ensure a clean handoff. Their coordination with the 1st Infantry and the 1st Infantry's execution of the maneuver would be flat well done and a tribute to them all. It was only later that I learned of the initiative at all levels in both units that had made it happen. The third thing on my mind was our aviation deep attack. I thought there was a good chance we would need two that night. To give us time for them, the first was scheduled to go at 2100. Which would make for some complications, since they would be flying out over the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment and then returning over the 1st Infantry. To simplify, we could have waited until the passage of the two units was complete, but that would have eliminated the chance to attack again if it was necessary. It was a risk, but it was a risk worth taking. By now, 7th Corps had been attacking for a little more than 50 hours without pause. We had gone about 150 kilometers, and our attack was about 24 hours ahead of all the pre-war projections of movement. At this point, late at night, with the sounds of battle close by, my emotions were running high. I wanted to pour it on the Iraqis, just pound them in an unrelenting attack with everything we had. We had the fist where we wanted it, and wanted to drive it home, go for the knockout. I was not alone in these feelings. You could sense the same thing all over the Corps. The Army calls it the warrior spirit, but it is more than that. It's about being a warrior, yes, but also a soldier, which means the disciplined application of force according to the laws of land warfare and our own values as a people. It goes beyond being a warrior. And so, as warriors and soldiers, we all experienced this go-for-it-and-win feeling. It was nothing personal, but if they wanted a fight, they had come to the right place. There was no holding back. That night was the most intense of the war, with the most concurrent activities. For me as the 7th Corps commander, for the soldiers in the tanks and Bradleys, for the small unit commanders trying to maintain order in their attack east in the dark, for my brigade and division commanders. The largest Corps tank force in the history of the U.S. Army was on the attack. Some of our soldiers would be wounded that night. Some would not see another day. I knew all that and felt I should remain awake while it was going on, but the truth was it was no longer in my hands. The orders had been given, and now it was up to the major unit commanders and their subordinate commanders and the soldiers to execute them. The best thing I could do was get some rest. It was still dark when I awoke at 0400, but by now the sounds of battle to the east had passed us by. During the night of 26-27 February, our attack had gone about 40 to 60 kilometers into the Iraqi defense. The 1st UK had secured Objective Waterloo, and as I had ordered, they were prepared to attack to the northeast behind the Iraqis in front of the 1st Infantry to Objective Denver. 1st Infantry, the Big Red One, had begun passage of lines through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment at about 2200 and finished at 0200. By daylight, the Big Red One had seized Norfolk, an objective we had placed about 30 kilometers east of Phase Line Smash, and was pressing toward Highway 8. By this time, the 3rd Armored Division had come online in the middle of the 7th Corps attack. They would cut a swath of destruction through the Iraqi Republican Guard's middle. I did not believe the Iraqis expected 3 armored divisions to hit them at night online. I wanted to pour it on with everything we had. Time was not only running out in the war, it was running out for some of our units who had had little rest the last few days. 3rd Armored Division destroyed hundreds of enemy vehicles and captured many prisoners. 1st Armored Division had likewise been attacking all night and was still at it. By now, Ron Griffith had brought his 3 maneuver brigades up online and seemed tied in well with 3rd Armored Division to his south. They still had an open flank to their north, for the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment and 24th Division were about 60 kilometers to their rear or west after their 90-degree turn. That gap continued to concern me for 2 reasons. The first had to do with the security of the 1st Armored Division and its vulnerability to attacks from the north, either by ground forces or artillery. The second was that if the 3rd Army was looking at a coordinated 7th Corps, 18th Corps attack against the Republican Guards, things would have to happen fast. There were 2 decisions to be made that day. How to fit the 1st Cav into the fight to destroy the Hammurabi in the north, and what force to commit as the southern arm of our envelopment in the south, the 1st Infantry or the British. On the one hand, the British were available. On the other hand, if the 1st Infantry had broken through, it meant they were closer, and I would use them. That is what I had to find out. The picture of the Iraqi intent was clear that morning. They continued to use their theater reserve, the Republican Guards, to form successive lines of defense against our attack. These began with the Tal Khana, then shifted to the Medina, then the Hammurabi. After the war, I found out that the mission of Iraqi ground forces on 27 February continued to be a hasty defense in depth to delay the advance of coalition forces until all forces withdrew from Kuwait and successfully crossed the Euphrates River. The remainder of the Tawakana Mech Division and the repositioned Medina Armored Division of the Republican Guards were to block any further penetration of 7th Corps forces coming from the west. Though I did not know all this on the morning of 27 February, I knew enough to determine that we were into a series of hastily defended positions, and that the troops we were facing were attempting to fight us, even though up to now the skill level and combat power had been a mismatch. As soon as it began to get light, we flew the 20 minutes it took to find 1st Infantry. I wanted to get their assessment and decide early about the attack north. Either 1st Infantry or 1st UK. A defeated enemy's equipment rushed underneath the helicopter as we flew to link up with the Big Red One. As far as we could see, there were burning vehicles. Tanks without turrets, burning. BMPs burning and overturned. Some equipment obviously hit from the air by LGBs, laser-guided bombs, as the tanks were without turrets and the hulls were almost flattened. Trucks were on fire. Black smoke rose in small columns from burning vehicles littering the sand. Iraqi dead lay on the battlefield. I had seen battle destruction before, but never like this. Visions from World War II newsreels made their way into my head as I searched for something to relate it to. There was brown sand and hundreds of broken and burning Iraqi vehicles all the way to the 1st Infantry Taxi P. Don't Look Back had been my code ever since I decided to have my leg amputated. But if I had been of a mind to, I would have concluded that I had made the right choice to pass the 1st Infantry through the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment to continue the attack the night before. At 06:30, we landed at the 1st Infantry Division Taxi P. My senses told me that here, at least, the Iraqis were a beaten army. I took a good look at the prisoners who avoided my eyes. They were reasonably clothed in military uniforms, but were dirty and unshaven, and were eating MREs, meals ready to eat, that our troops had given them. They looked tired, but no more so than the U.S. soldiers guarding them. Unlike our soldiers, though, they were passive, shuffling around, not talking much with one another. They looked defeated. Brigadier General Bill Carter greeted me when I walked into the TAC. I told him, "Bill, hell of a fight last night. Saw the destruction on the way over. Give me a sit rep. By the way, where's Tom?" He replied, "It was a tough fight last night. We think we've broken through. Resistance is much less organized than what we ran into last night. Not sure what the Iraqis are doing, but they are not in any coherent defenses. We did have a number of casualties last night. Do not have a final count, but we had about 8 killed in action, maybe 30 wounded. General Rahm is forward with one of the brigades in a tank. I have him on the radio." So I talked with Tom and told him to press the attack east, that I'd give the details to Bill. Moments later, Bill Carter and I and his planners were clustered beside a map. As I looked at it, a piece of blue representing the Persian Gulf was just visible at the far eastern corner of the eastern map sheet. It caught my attention. Attack east. Go for the blue on the map. That is what is bringing the ships to take us home when this is over. Go for that. Here, I said, banging on the map. Not too military, but I wanted them, as clearly tired as they were, to have something to seize on to propel them forward another 24 hours. Then I quickly sketched out how the 1st Cav would attack around the 1st Armored Division in the north later that day, while the 1st and 3rd Armored Divisions would be the pressure forces continuing to attack due east, and the 1st Infantry would attack east through Denver across Highway 8 toward the Gulf. We now had work to do to get the order out and executed that I had just sketched. At 07:15, we flew to our TAC forward, close to the 3rd Armored Division TAC, about a 20-minute flight back over the smoking ruins of the better part of 2 Iraqi brigades. There, I linked up with Lieutenant Colonel Dave McKiernan and his crew. I needed Dave to understand what I wanted done and to begin making the orders overlays while I went to lay out my intent face-to-face with the commanders. While I was at the TAC, I talked to John Yosik twice to describe our progress and what I had seen, to go over our double envelopment scheme of maneuver. I cannot help but think that the end of the war might have turned out differently if they had been able to continue forward, and we could have finalized the 7th Corps, 18th Corps coordinated final attack. That would have completed the 3-for-3 Heavy Division Republican Guard's destruction. It never happened. At 07:45, I linked up with Butch Funk well forward in the 3rd Armored Division's attack zone and told him what I was trying to get done that day. After I left Butch, I flew to meet Ron Griffith at the 1st Armored Division TAC CP. My positive feelings changed abruptly when I saw the 1st Armored Division TAC in the middle of what appeared to be a stopped division. Ron probably could read my mind as he greeted me. He said, "I know you want us to continue the attack, but I'm just about out of fuel. I figure we have about another 2 hours, then the division will come to a complete halt." Friction. Shit. Damn it, we just have to keep moving, and I'll get you fuel from somewhere. Just keep attacking like you've been doing. Very quickly, I went over to the 1st Armored Division comms and called the TAC. "Get some fuel to the 1st Armored Division, top priority over anything else." I also ordered the 3rd Armored Division to send some fuel to the north to 1st Armored Division. Stopping because you are out of fuel is a fatal flaw, and to run out of fuel here on top of the world's greatest supply of oil was just too much. The 1st Armored Division had come farther than any other unit in the Corps, using about 500,000 to 750,000 gallons of fuel a day. And that is a lot of fuel trucks, especially when each one carries 2,500 or 5,000 gallons. And the turnaround time from Corps fuel sites was by now 24 hours or greater. I was not happy with this situation. Forget logistics and you lose. Our choices were really two. One was to stop the division and pass the 1st cab through to take up the fight. The alternative was for Ron to keep attacking and take the risk that the tankers would catch up. I ordered Ron to keep moving. By late that night, 1st Armored Division got about 100,000 gallons of fuel, but it had been close. The division had certainly been within 2 hours of running out of fuel. After dealing with that, I got a quick update on the 1st Armored Division situation and stressed to Ron that I wanted him to make room in the north by necking down the division zone and allowing the 1st Cav to pass to the north. I left to go back to the tack forward to brief the order to the other commanders. Now that I had given the double envelopment order personally to 1st Infantry, 3rd Armored Division, and 1st Armored Division, it was time to talk to 1st Cav and 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, as well as to get the overlays out. The time for them to execute was compressed, but I thought we could do it. At 1300, while I was at the 1st Cav tack, I got a call from 1st Armored Division. They were engaged with a brigade of the Medina Division in a large tank fight, and it was going well for the 1st Armored Division. As it turned out, that call was about the Battle of Medina Ridge, our largest individual tank battle of the war. At 1800, back at 7th Corps TAC CP, I made my usual call to John Yosik to give him a sit rep before his 1900 meeting with General Schwarzkopf. I reported that Iraqi resistance was becoming less coherent and that 1st Infantry was in pursuit, but that 1st and 3rd Armored Divisions were still in hasty attack mode. I then updated him on our double envelopment maneuver. We needed another 24 hours or so, I told him, and it would be all over. Another 24 hours was about what we could get, he thought. After that call, Stan, Creighton Abrams, and I went over the next day's operation. We figured there was nothing the Iraqis could do to stop us from our double envelopment maneuver. By the end of the day, or at the latest by Friday morning, the Republican Guards would be destroyed, not only in our sector, but in the Kuwaiti theater of operations, as 18th Corps closed in from the north.
G plus 3, the rest of the theater. In the west, on the afternoon of the 27th, 18th Corps changed its orientation from north toward the Euphrates to east toward Basra, and then moved to close the by now expanding gap with 7th Corps. Meanwhile, the airfield at Hajul, a few kilometers north of Al Busaya, was converted by elements of the 101st Airborne into a forward operating base. From this base, 101st Apaches attacked 145 kilometers farther east into what was called Engagement Area Thomas. Thomas was a kill box directly north of Basra, through which ran the highway north that was thought to be a major exit route for Iraqi armor. The next morning, the 101st commander, General Pei, planned to air assault his 1st Brigade into Thomas. If they could get forces on the ground to cut the highway north out of Basra, it was thought they would strangle the last escape route of the Republican Guards. The ceasefire put a stop to this plan. Meanwhile, the heaviest punch out of 18th Corps, the 24th MEC, attacked and captured Jaliba Airfield. Not far from Jaliba, the division ran into huge logistics and ammunition storage sites. Though Iraqi artillery tried to lay fires down on the rapidly advancing columns, they didn't do any damage. That afternoon, the 24th took more than 1,300 Iraqi ammunition bunkers and captured more than 5,000 Iraqi soldiers. In Kuwait, the Marines had come close to completing their mission. At 0600 the morning of the 27th, elements of the 1st Division made the final assault on the international airport. It wasn't long before they took down the Iraqi colors and raised the U.S. and Kuwaiti flags. The U.S. flag soon came down for the sake of diplomatic decorum. By 0900, Kuwaiti forces, supported by Egyptian armor and other Arab forces, entered Kuwait City. Coalition forces found a city that had been sacked. Many of its citizens had been tortured with acid baths, electric drills, and electric prods, killed, dismemberment, shooting, or beating to death were frequent methods, or raped. Scattered along the so-called Highway of Death, littered around the ruined and mostly stolen cars and trucks, was a partial inventory of the loot from Kuwait City: television sets, washing machines, carpets, scuba gear, jewelry. After the Arabs took the city, the Marines entered. When they did, the Kuwaitis came out like Parisians in August 1944, saying, "God bless Bush. Thank you, USA. Thank you, thank you, thank you." By evening in Riyadh, momentum was growing in Washington for a ceasefire. And at 2100, 1300 in Washington, General Schwarzkopf gave the live, televised mother of all briefings that, in essence, declared victory. Although he allowed that armored battles were still going on, the SINK indicated that he would happily stop fighting if the order came to do that. He did not have long to wait.
The next 12 hours brought an end to the war for 7th Corps. On into the night, we continued to fight a series of close battles. I figured our biggest remaining future fights were going to be in the north, with what remained of the Hammurabi. That fight would take place late the next morning, 28 February, somewhere west of the Rumalia oil fields, and it would be over before the evening, very much like the Medina fight with the 1st Armored Division. Thus, I figured that by 1800 the next day, our double envelopment would be complete. I'd had 7th Corps attacking for almost 4 days straight. Soon we would be at the limit of soldier and leader endurance, but we were not there yet. I left the TAC and went outside to smoke a cigar. When I returned at around 21:30, Stan had been talking to John Landry at the main. There was talk of a ceasefire in the morning. Total surprise. Ceasefire. Who the hell's idea is that? I called John Yosik right away, and John confirmed the news. I repeated that our situation was a combination of pursuit and hasty attack. Another 24 hours or so would finish it. John agreed, but meanwhile he directed us to put out a warning order for a possible cessation of offensive operations in the morning. I was stunned, but we put out the warning order. None of my commanders came back on the radio to protest stopping. When we confirmed the rumors of a ceasefire, the air went out of the balloon. When we put the order out just before midnight, we could just feel the Corps attack momentum come to a halt. At 23:37, we got the official written order from 3rd Army that the cessation would take place the next day at 0500, and we put out our own order soon after that. I left sometime at around 0100. While walking to the tent, I told Toby how proud I was of everybody in 7th Corps, and how severely disappointed I was that I couldn't get the 1st Cav into the fight. The problem was that, while it was over, I felt a nagging sense of incompletion. 1st Squadron, 7th Cavalry, 1st Cav Division was within 60 kilometers of Basra. 1st Armored Division Apaches could see the Gulf. 3rd Armored Division was within 30 kilometers of Highway 8 and our objective Denver. 1st Infantry was less than 20 kilometers from Safwan. The British were across Highway 8 north of Kuwait City. At 0300, 28 February, Toby jolted me awake. "General Franks, we have new orders from 3rd Army." "What the hell is it now?" Although I was waking up quickly, as soldiers learn to do, I was also shooting the messenger. Third Army has ordered a new time for the secession, from 0500 to 0800. G3 thinks you should come over to the TAC. Okay, thanks, Toby. I'll be right there. I got my leg on in the dark and walked into the bright lights of the TAC. At 0315, I called John Yosik to get clarification, and John confirmed the change. Not only did we have a change of secession time from 0500 to 0800, he said, but we were to ensure maximum destruction of enemy equipment. The next order for us was truly puzzling. It was very important for us to get to the crossroads at Safwan, John told me, to prevent any Iraqi units from escaping by that route. Why the Safwan crossroads had suddenly become a high priority escaped me. The 1st Infantry had already cut Highway 8 south of Safwan. But an order is an order. I said Wilco and called Stan over for a huddle. I had interpreted John's order as one to stop movement through the road junction. The tactics were up to me. Stan circled Safwan on the map hanging in front of us. My first thought was to go after it with the 11th Aviation Brigade. With Apaches to interdict traffic, that would get a presence there immediately, and ground troops would follow later. A second look at the map showed that such an attack by Corps Aviation risked getting in the way of the 1st Infantry. I directed an order to go out to all of 7th Corps. They were to continue to attack in the same direction and with the same objectives we had been using prior to the early evening adjustments. They were to continue the attack until 0800, not 0500, and until that time they were to destroy maximum equipment. This order also put the 1st Infantry back on their earlier line of attack, that is, generally northeast. My assumption was that if our map posting was accurate, if they were indeed 20 to 30 kilometers from Safwan, then the 1st Infantry would easily get to those crossroads by 0800. I also figured their own Apaches would get there much sooner. I should have known we would have confusion. At the end of my briefing on 9 February, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney asked me, "How will it all end?" Here, to the best of my knowledge, is the story of how the decision was made that brought us to the actual end state on the battlefield. In the evening of 27 February, following General Schwarzkopf's mother of all briefings, during which the SYNC essentially said that the escape door was shut and declared victory, General Colin Powell called Schwarzkopf to tell him that the president was thinking of ending the war within a matter of hours, but would defer that decision to the theater commander. General Schwarzkopf replied that he would poll his commanders before giving a final judgment. That poll never got to the tactical battlefield. In the call back to Powell, General Schwarzkopf confirmed that it was time to end the fighting. After that theater judgment, the Joint Chiefs agreed unanimously that the war had achieved its goals and should stop. The order went to Third Army, and from Third Army to us. Could we have gone on? Absolutely. Would that have made good tactical sense? From where I was standing, absolutely. Would another 12 hours have destroyed more of Saddam's army? Absolutely, though not much in our sector. I was not thinking about any of that on the morning of 28 February. I simply trusted those who were making the strategic decisions. That was the difference between the end of this war and of the one in Vietnam. From President Bush to the soldiers in our tanks, it was a matter of trust reunited. Our 7th Corps tactical victories had not taken 89 hours. They had taken almost 20 years. At 0630, as it was approaching daylight, reports of operations were coming in over the radio. At 0700, John Tallely of 1st Cav called to tell me that he was ready to attack if I wanted to exercise that option. It was 1 hour before the end. It ripped me up inside. I could picture the 1st Cav leaning forward in the saddle, as it were. "No," I told John, "we are out of time." Just before 0800, the 1st Armored Division reported they had captured the headquarters of the Medina Division. That was great news. At precisely 0800, I got on the radio and told units to cease fire. It was over. We had attacked close to 250 kilometers in 89 hours with five divisions, day and night, in sandstorms and rain. It had been an incredible battlefield performance by the soldiers and leaders of 7th Corps. We had accomplished our mission to destroy the Republican Guard's forces in our sector. The Tawakana had ceased to exist as a division. The Medina was down to a few battalions. The better part of 11 Iraqi divisions lay in the wake of the 7th Corps attack, including the two Republican Guards divisions. Corps units had destroyed 1,350 tanks, 1,224 personnel carriers of all types, 285 artillery pieces, 105 air defense pieces, and 1,229 trucks. Though we had counted more than 22,000 Iraqi prisoners, since our units lost count, the true figure was probably as high as double that. In the 89 hours, we had fired a total of 55,000 artillery rounds and 10,500 MLRS rockets, and we had also fired 25 ATACMs in 21 missions. We'd used 348 close support airstrikes, mainly A-10s, and mainly in the daylight. Kuwait was liberated. But it had come at a price. The final figure was 46 killed in action and 196 U.S. wounded, and 16 British soldiers killed in action and 61 wounded. I will never forget them for the rest of my life. 11 M1A1s were damaged and 4 were destroyed, 16 Bradleys damaged and 9 destroyed, 1 Apache damaged and 1 destroyed. I say again, it was fast, but it was not easy. Let no one equate swiftness with ease. It was a total team effort, as we'd known it would be. I was humbled to have had the privilege to lead such a magnificent armored corps into battle. Their battlefield achievements had come about because of 20 years of rebuilding, and because of their courage and selfless sense of duty. That I had been permitted to return to battle with that army after we had both been badly wounded was something more than I could ever have dreamed of. Now, with the ceasefire ordered, we had some other orders to get out. First, I wanted the Corps to understand the rules of engagement. In particular, I wanted them to know they had the right of self-defense. Second, we had some minor repositioning to do in order to get into a better and more coherent posture. Third, I was concerned about force protection, especially unexploded munitions, which numbered in the tens of thousands all over the battlefield. Just getting out of your vehicle in the dark had become hazardous. Fourth, I wanted the Corps to stop taking the PSG pills and to get out of the by-now nasty chemical overgarments we had worn day and night since 24 February. After taking care of these orders, I wanted to get out and around the Corps as soon as possible and personally congratulate as many units and commanders as I could. 0301 March, 1991. Another early morning phone call from Riyadh. I was asleep in my small tent at the TAC. It was John Yosik. There will be ceasefire talks tomorrow, and 7th Corps will be responsible to set up the site. The SYNC also wants recommendations about the best place to hold the talks. I said, let me ask around and I'll get back to you. We made calls to the units in the Corps to find out their views about sites, and the one that I liked best was the Medina Division headquarters that 1st Armored Division had captured on the last day of the war. It would provide a great backdrop, since it would show the abandoned headquarters of one of the no longer elite divisions. All around it was destroyed Iraqi army equipment. It would perfectly communicate the magnitude of the defeat of Saddam's army to the world. At about 0400, John called back to ask for our recommendation, and I told him about the Medina Division headquarters. John seemed to like that, but he also asked if we had taken the crossroads in Safwan, as specified in the written order we had gotten the morning of 28 February. I told him we did not have troops there physically, but that we had gotten air there to interdict movement as I had understood the intent. He told me that would be a problem. Our written orders had been to seize it, and the sink thought we had it. Safwan was the site the sink favored for the talks, and he had already tentatively told Washington. I repeated that we did not have it. John told me the sink wanted to know why his orders had been disobeyed regarding that crossroads. I was absolutely stunned. My first reaction was real anger. I thought about the other war that had ended with my lower leg amputated. Now here in this war, I was to have my professional character amputated. I was really disappointed with the sink. To be accused of disobeying an order is to be accused of a serious breach of discipline, especially in wartime. More than the personal injury, though, was the sudden realization that this had been the first communication from the theater commander to 7th Corps after the war. No calls of thanks to the troops. No discussion of casualties. No calls to the locker room, as it were, for the men and women who had made all this possible. That anger burned hot for some time. We had interdicted the road junction but not seized it. There had been no intent to disobey orders. I had selected tactics to accomplish what I had interpreted to be the intent of the order. I had gotten those verbal orders from John at about 0330 on 28 February. The written order came later that morning. I and everyone else missed the seize in the written order. That was my fault. Any failure of the Corps to seize the road junction was my responsibility, but it was not failure based on disobeying an order. I could never understand why the sink's first reaction would be to accuse John Yosik and me of disobeying an order. Right after first light, I went to visit the 1st Infantry. I wanted to tell Tom Rahm what had to be done to get Safwan and to explain that it was now the site of the talks. Later that day, Tom sent his 2nd Brigade, commanded by Colonel Tony Marino, to get Safwan. In a superbly skilled use of persuasion supported by force, Tony Marino quite simply told the Iraqi commander to get the hell out of the way or he would kill them all. The Iraqis did not need more convincing. By 1600, we had Safwan, the airfield, and the road junction. Though the mission had to come first, I still had a driving urgency, fueled by the aftermath of Vietnam, to visit the troops and leaders to thank them for all they had done to win this victory. I also wanted to visit the hospitals and especially to talk to as many amputees as I could. I started the process that day, as did all my commanders. I also called Cal Waller to get a reading of the sink on the Safwan issue and the flap over our pace of attack. Cal explained, as I had guessed, that the problem was that the sink was embarrassed. Based on what he had been briefed, he had told the president we had the place for the talks. Then he was told we did not have it. When I asked Cal about the pace of attack problem, he told me that the sink had been upset over that a couple of days before, but now he was pleased about the whole operation. It even occurred to me that now maybe the sink regretted he'd raised the Safwan incident at all. On the morning of 2 March, I got a quick staff update on the enemy and on our own situation. Though the Rockies were in disarray, they were rapidly moving units and equipment out of the theater. They were clearly a beaten army and fleeing as fast as they could. After the briefing, I gave Stan guidance on our occupation duties. Next, I ordered the formation of a demolition task force to destroy abandoned and captured Iraqi equipment more rapidly than we'd been able to do up to that time. That same day at 1200 was to be the ceasefire meeting at Safwan. The site would be ready at noon, but it would be a primitive setup. A sign was put up that was visible to all those who entered the site. Welcome to Iraq, courtesy of the Big Red One. While I was there, we got the word that the Iraqis couldn't make it to that day's meeting, so the meeting had been postponed until the next day. We were glad to get 24 more hours. The extra time gave the 1st Infantry more time to prepare the site, and it gave me a chance to continue to visit units. My first stop was Troop G in 2nd Squadron, 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, one of the 3 cavalry troops to make the Battle of 73 Easting so successful. Captain Joe Sartiano gathered the troopers around a tank, and they spoke in whispered tones about what they had done. It is not unusual for those who have seen real combat to talk little about it, and almost never in loud locker room voices or language. My next stop was about 30 minutes south. With Major General Rupert Smith and the British, I found the same attitude as with the U.S. troops, quiet, but pleased and proud with what they had done. From the 1st UK, I flew back into Saudi Arabia to visit the soldiers in one of our evacuation hospitals. I was angry to learn that they had no Purple Hearts to award at the hospital. Normally, Purple Hearts are awarded in the hospital. We got that squared away with a few calls to the right people. The troops were hurting from their wounds and full of questions about their fellow soldiers and their units. I talked to all the amputees in that hospital and tried to share my own experience with them. They were American soldiers who had given it the best they had. All I wanted to do was say thanks, as I remembered my fellow amputees in the ward in Valley Forge so long ago. I flew in silence most of the hour and 15 minutes back to the core tack 200 kilometers into Iraq. At about 18:30, soon after I got back to the tack, I got a call from John Yosik. He said, "Fred, the SYNC wants you to escort him to the talks at Safwan tomorrow." That was a real shocker. The SYNC wants me to escort him? Me? You sure about that? I'm sure. Wilco. I'd be there. On 3 March 1991, I was up before first light. This would be a big day. Our troops had reported they would be ready when General Schwarzkopf arrived. Since this was the SYNC's first visit north of the Saudi border and to the battlefield, I also wanted to preview what I might show him on our 30-minute flight from Kuwait City Airport to Safwan. On the way to the airfield, we flew over the so-called Highway of Death just north of Kuwait City. We also flew by burning oil wells. Hundreds were visible. We flew over the destruction in the desert that had been delivered by the 1st Infantry as they cut a swath through the Iraqis to Highway 8. When we landed at Kuwait City International Airport, as you might expect, it looked as if it had been in a war. At 09:30, General Schwarzkopf arrived in a modern civilian Gulfstream jet. I was a bit uneasy. Not only was this a big day, but just the day before, he had accused me of disobeying an order. The issue did not come up. As we took off for Safwan, I let the SYNC know I wouldn't bother him with a lot of chatter, since I knew he had a lot on his mind, and that we would fly lower and slower than usual, so that he would have a chance to look around. As we flew over the burning oil wells, he was as shocked as the rest of us by that tragedy. Shortly after, we circled to get a closer look at the Highway of Death. Then we went a little west of Highway 8 so that I could point out the destroyed Iraqi equipment. It stretched as far as we could see, and it impressed him. He was clearly pleased. "Just like we planned it, Fred." After the SYNC said that, I figured that all the problems and confusions of the previous 4 days had gone away, and I never expected to hear of them again. At Safwan, General Schwarzkopf seemed very sure of himself as he looked around, chatted briefly with the troops, and waited for the Iraqis to arrive. When the Iraqis rode up in our Humvees and got out, they gave him a salute, which General Schwarzkopf returned. Through an interpreter, he explained the setup and the first order of business. They would be searched and would have to surrender any weapons. He would also be searched, he explained. They agreed, and that formality was accomplished. General Schwarzkopf then led them into the tent, followed by the coalition delegation. When I started to enter, I got stopped at the door by the CENTCOM security troops. My name was not on the CENTCOM list, they told me. I said, I'm going in, name or no name. I found an empty seat in the back by the entrance. It was hot in the tent, and I could hear nothing of what was said at the table. I had a hard time staying awake. General Schwarzkopf seemed to be doing most of the talking, and the Iraqis were very still. They nodded now and then, but said little. It was clear to me what was going on. This was a battlefield meeting of the commanders of the opposing forces to agree on the separation of forces. Later, more detailed strategic-level talks would determine the Iraqi penalty for their aggression against Kuwait. After about an hour, they took a short break. As the Iraqi generals walked by me, I looked into their eyes. These men had the coldest-looking, most impassive expressions I have ever seen on military officers. After the break, I stayed outside for a while. Later, I went back inside. General Schwarzkopf seemed to be on top of his game, and I was confident he would do for us what was right. We had done our part. The talks ended and the tent emptied. They had lasted about an hour and a half. Afterward, General Schwarzkopf and Lieutenant General Khalid held a session with the media, right in front of the big red one tanks and their sign. After the press conference, Toby grabbed me. General Schwarzkopf wants to see you in his tent. The SYNC wanted me to listen as he reported the results of the talks to General Powell. The agreement had a number of provisions. There was to be a demilitarized zone 2 kilometers wide to separate the forces. There were rules of engagement. The intent was not to engage if Iraqi forces were trying to get away. Vehicles and helos flying an orange panel would not be engaged. We were not to get into big battles if all the Iraqis were doing was trying to get out of the theater. Bypassed Iraqi units were to be allowed to leave. We were to be on weapons hold unless the Iraqis showed clear hostile intent, and the Iraqis were not to be allowed to remove ammunition. General Schwarzkopf also said we would not give up 1 square inch of Iraqi territory until the permanent ceasefire was signed. He emphasized that all forces were to have the right of self-defense. At about 14:30, we got back in the Black Hawk and flew to Kuwait City with the same escort. Once again, it seemed to me that General Schwarzkopf felt good about the day's events. There are many things to do after the shooting stops. Despite the urgency everyone feels, you do not just declare a halt, cease firing, and then turn around and go home. The speed with which units can switch from all-ahead, full-speed combat to post-combat operations is a matter of both command will and the discipline of soldiers. Our soldiers again proved to be superb. The Third Army had its hands full. After the coalition had kicked out the Iraqis, they rolled into Kuwait City and went to work. In occupied Iraq, it was a different story. Things in Iraq could not remain the same while everyone waited for the ceasefire. Permanent residents of towns and villages began to appear, as did refugees. Food and water were in short supply. Except for what we could provide, there was no law and order. Likewise, without us, there were no medical facilities. During those weeks, we spent considerable time going over the battles we had just fought. I directed each unit to conduct an after-action review of its unit actions while it was all fresh in everyone's mind. We recorded all our lessons learned, as well as made notes for what needed to be improved for the future. We learned that our soldiers, training, organizations, doctrine, and equipment were as able as we had thought they were. It was also a vindication of the total army concept that included the reserve component. There were also some things we needed to look at for the future of land warfare. I thought Desert Storm represented a transition war. In fact, all wars are transition wars. A lot of the old methods bear repeating in the future, but also some of the new ones. I also thought our possible enemies of the future were watching this war and taking notes. If they ever confronted the United States on a battlefield, they would attempt to stay away from some of our strengths and take note of our weaknesses. we would have to continue to maintain the edge. I filed it all away in my own notes to look at after we had some more time and perspective. The task of destroying enemy equipment was vast, and went on from the beginning of the war on 24 February until we left Iraq for good on 9 May. It was in the area of humanitarian operations that we were least prepared and experienced the most frustrations. Our work fell into two periods. The first lasted from the beginning of the refugee influx on about 15 March to the signing of the UN-sponsored peace treaty on 12 April. The second lasted from 12 April to 9 May, when almost 20,000 refugees under U.S. protection were settled in a camp in Saudi Arabia. As the signing of the ceasefire came closer, there began to be talk that we would have to leave a residual force in Kuwait, and I was informed that it was true when Secretary of Defense Cheney visited on 7 May. He told me the Kuwaitis wanted us to stay until the end of the year, but that the president would decide that. The brigade selected to remain was a composite 1st Brigade made up of units from other brigades. Because the decision had come so late, some of the soldiers were on airplanes about to leave, and we had to get them off and take them back to their equipment in Kuwait. It was not a good time for the troops. They had come on no notice, trained hard, won a great victory, done unexpected humanitarian work in and around Safwan, and now this. On my last day in country, 11 May, I flew the 400 kilometers from King Khalid Military City to Kuwait to visit with the soldiers whom I had ordered to stay. I wanted to look them in the eye and explain why. It was not an easy meeting. They were hostile at first. I told them we had won a great victory, and that in the judgment of our government, a residual force was needed to continue to ensure that it lasted. It was a matter of trust. The soldiers accepted it and said, "Okay, we'll get on with it. It's our duty." One of the first things I did when I got back to Germany was to visit the families in Gießen whose military spouses had remained in Kuwait. Like their military spouses, they accepted it without question. I promised them their spouses would be home within 45 days. They were home in 36. Then it was time for closure. 7th Corps had many ceremonies, and the individual units had their own. On 31 May, at Kelly Barracks near Stuttgart, we had the most emotional ceremony of all. In the small soldier chapel there, amid the stained glass windows, we paid tribute to the lasting memory of those who had lost their lives in Desert Storm. On 27 June, at Kelly Barracks, all units who had been members of the 7th Corps Desert Storm Team, 900 soldiers and commanders, including the British, with their own band and the French, assembled to honor the Corps. Special guests included Ambassador Walters, General Sullivan, the new Army Chief, and General Butch Saint. General Colin Powell flew over specially to attend the ceremony and spoke warmly and emotionally to those assembled. Following the ceremony, he stayed to greet as many people as possible in the open reception, then flew straight back to Washington. It was another reminder to me of the difference between Desert Storm and Vietnam. General Powell's leadership was one big reason. In September 1991, Denise and I were invited back to our hometown of Reading, Pennsylvania, for a parade and other ceremonies to honor all Desert Storm veterans from Reading and Berks County. There were other parades as well, in New York and in Washington. For the rest of my life, I will remember the generosity of our fellow citizens to our soldiers who went and did their duty. It was not like before, not like after Vietnam. "Don't worry, General, we trust you." I'll never forget that. Trust reunited.
That same year, Fred Franks received a 4th star and a new post as Commanding General of the U.S. Army's Training and Doctrine Command, TRADOC, at Fortress Monroe in the Virginia Tidewater. It was Fred Frank's and Tradoc's job not only to lead the intellectual change in ideas and in doctrine that would ensure the Army could quickly adapt to a new strategic situation, but to lay the groundwork for the changes needed to meet the requirements of the first two decades of the 21st century. The Army is a conservative institution, and you want that. They deal in life and death decisions. The price for failure to prepare is loss of your most precious resource, your soldiers. That was demonstrated in the American Civil War, when leaders used Napoleonic methods of attack in the face of rifles that were 10 times more accurate than when the tactics had been devised. The challenge for Tradoc was to prevent something similar to that from happening the next year, or in 2003, or 2010. The days of mobilization of a large standing army to fight the Soviets were over. The U.S. Army was now becoming a smaller army. It now needed to become a force projection army. It now had to be able to deploy large organizations overseas quickly. Battle and operational environments were going to be hard to predict. This meant that the Army had to be able not only to fight and win in several different types of battlefields, but also to accomplish several types of operations other than war. And this, in turn, meant that the Army's doctrine had to address the issue of the smaller forces' versatility. It also meant doing away with the term air-land battle, not because the concept was no longer useful, but because it suggested the linear battlefield of Central Europe. For example, Fred Franks and his team created a concept in 1991 under which all the various ideas about the evolving battlefield could be included. It was called battle dynamics. There were 5 central ideas to battle dynamics: battle command, battle space, depth and simultaneous attack, early entry, lethality and survivability, combat service support. First, battle command. Battle command is decision making. The commander will visualize the present friendly and enemy situations, then the situation that must occur if his mission is to be achieved at least cost to his soldiers, and then devise tactical methods to get from one state to the other. He will do all this while being with his soldiers, while feeling their pain and pride, and then making the necessary decisions. Second, battle space. Battle lines between opposing forces may well be much more amorphous than they are now. Thus, Franks wanted Army commanders to think their way through the tactical problems of the likely fluid, free-form, and ambiguous future battlefield without automatically applying Cold War battle space templates. Third, depth and simultaneous attack. In the past, there had been a segmented sequential battlefield model of rear, close, and deep. In future operations, we would attack the enemy or control a situation in operations other than war simultaneously, not sequentially, throughout the depth of the battle space. Fourth, early entry, lethality, and survivability. In a fast-moving situation, when a force has to go into an area quickly, called early entry, you want to be able to tailor it so that it goes in with power and protection. In short, they have to be able to win the first battle. Fifth, combat service support. Tactical logistics will also continue to be one of the keys to more rapid tempo operations. Anticipation will sometimes be aided by what are called telemetry-based logistics. Telemetry on equipment will allow support personnel to know when something is needed before it is needed. But ideas are not enough. Franks concluded that the Army needed to do some experimenting, and the Tradoc Battlefield Laboratories were formed in April 1992. There were 5 of them, each corresponding to a core idea of battle dynamics, a single area where the land battle was changing. As for the future battlefield, the outcome of land battles will still be decided by physical force, but there are changes. The emergence of information technology, operated by truly high-quality soldiers, is bringing about a revolution in land warfare. In the not-at-all-distant future, commanders will find themselves on a battlefield where all soldiers and weapons platforms will carry sensors. With their help, soldiers will not only know precisely where they are, They will also be able to engage the enemy directly and at the same time to transmit information about the enemy to other platforms that also can engage the enemy. So the trend in land combat has been toward fewer and fewer friendly forces in a given battle space. Fewer soldiers in a given battle space wielding the same lethality against the enemy means you don't have to protect so much of your own force, and all your troops know what is going on. As the Army forges into that future, it faces a multitude of questions of ever-growing complexity, but it knows how to go about solving them. Fred Franks retired from TRADOC in 1994, but today TRADOC continues to experiment, continues to work on the answers. Fred Franks has the last word.
On 5 May 1970, the day I was wounded near Snoel, Cambodia, I could never have predicted the course the next 25 years would take. Years that ended at a retirement ceremony at Fort Myer, Virginia, after I had completed 35 and a half years in the Army. I believe generals get to focus on and solve big problems in peace and war. They must know details and occasionally dip into those, but essentially they must figure out the few deciding issues or battles for their times and conditions and focus their energies on those. These are what I called points of main effort. They cannot be many. You have to decide what they are and make them stick. Finally, there is my own family. Denise, my high school sweetheart, an Army wife of now 38 years. My best friend and a woman of great compassion and courage. Margie, our special treasure of a daughter. Our intense love and depth of wisdom about each other and about what is of value born in the Valley Forge Crucible. Now there is Margie's family. Her soldier husband, Greg, and our three grandchildren, Jake, Mickey, and Denise. There is my dad, who gave me an inscribed clock when I retired. A boyhood dream becomes a reality. Congratulations, son, on your retirement from a distinguished career of faithful service to the U.S. Army and your country. Love, Dad. My mom, gone, but never forgotten. The Army has been like a bigger family for Denise and me. As she is fond of saying, she remembers new friends, old friends, and forever friends. We had both grown up in West Lawn and West Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, in the 1940s, 1950s, so there were many excellent models for us. Each place we lived, we tried to make our hometown. Those we served with became like family. Just like family, there was an intense loyalty in the units. You protected your family. You kept in touch with your family. One of the lasting truths about being a soldier is that friendships formed with comrades in arms are the deepest and most enduring. My wife Denise and I were privileged beyond words to have made those friendships. I was humbled and proud to have been able to serve our nation and to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America in the United States Army in peace and two wars. That I was permitted to remain on active duty following the amputation of my left leg below the knee, and that I was given every opportunity to serve by Army leaders, by policy, and by my fellow soldiers has been life's great privilege. My everlasting thanks to this great and noble institution, to our nation which it serves, and to the soldiers in whose ranks I was permitted to serve for 35 and a half years.
Into the Storm, a study in command, was written by Tom Clancy with General Fred Franks, Jr. It was read by Boyd Gaines with Ken Jenkins as General Fred Franks, Jr. It was abridged for audio by George Truitt. The recording engineers were Paul Fowley and Jamie Cerniglia. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The associate producer was Sloane Seaman. Into the Storm was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Tom Clancy, SSN, featuring Joe Morton and Boyd Gaines. The Sum of All Fears, Clear and Present Danger, and Cardinal of the Kremlin.